Our host needs no introduction.
His name is...
A name so simple it rolls right off your tongue.
His name is James... No, his name is... James Lawrence! Lawrence!
Try again.
Forrest Lone... Lars! Lars!
No! Chuck Jaffe.
Yes! 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 We're like this!
I'll say it again so you remember, okay? This is Money Life with Chuck Jaffe.
Wow! 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 All I can say is wow!
Please do not overdramatize these proceedings.
And now, here's Chuck.
He's one in a million.
He sure is.
It's Thursday, April 7th, and this is Money Life with Chuck Jaffe. Welcome to the show. I'm Chuck Jaffe, your host for the next hour. We're going to guide you through four terrific interviews today and a little bit of fun with me as well. So let me tell you what we've got on tap. It's Thursday. Our regulars, that's Tom Lydon from ETF Trends and Bob Powell, editor of Retirement Weekly. Tom, of course, brings you the ETF of the week. Bob, well, he's going to be talking about what amounts to big news that's sort of not big news. It's big news in my world. It's big news when you talk about financial advisors. But yesterday, the fiduciary rule was finally put forth by the Department of Labor. Fiduciary, the F word, as I have taken to calling it, the swear word for so many folks in the financial world. But the problem here is not that the rule itself is not good. It's that the rule is going to lead to confusion. And we'll talk a little bit about that. But if you want to know more about that, well, I wrote a column about a week, 10 days ago, saying here's what's going to happen when they come out with the fiduciary rule. So I didn't need to change it or update it because guess what? I was right. And that's my job. Now, between Tom and Bob, our big interview today is with Patrick O'Hare, chief market strategist for Briefing.com. And after Bob, our Money Life market call today is with Leah Bennett. She is co-chief investment officer for South Texas Money Management. So that is our lineup. I'm glad you're here. I'm Chuck Jaffe, senior columnist for MarketWatch, host of this show every weekday. You will find my columns online at MarketWatch.com. And if you want help finding them, follow me on Twitter, at MKTWJaffe. By the way, while I usually tweet mostly about my columns, I sometimes tweet about interesting stuff that I read. I don't do too much of it, but there was a great piece yesterday on MarketWatch done by Stephen Cutts talking about the NFL teaching players and their families about personal finance. Really fun read. And if you ever have wondered about that stuff, since there are so many horror stories about pro athletes running out of money, they work pretty hard in all the leagues these days to not let that happen. But this was an interesting take on it. And it was really designed for NFL players who are maybe getting their second contract. Not their rookie contract, but the second one. So very interesting stuff. You can check that out. But that's sometimes the stuff I tweet about when I'm doing anything extra just beyond tweeting my columns. Then, of course, there's the Money Life Twitter. That's at Money Life Show. And I tweet about what we're doing on the show, what we're talking about and hold it or fold it, that kind of stuff. And I've got some tweets coming about some guests that we've locked in because we have a great lineup coming. April is almost completely booked at this point, and boy, am I happy. I really couldn't be much happier with what we've got. I'm going to be excited to come to work every day, and I think I will be here every day. I think we're going to get a couple of shows done early because right now it's sort of the spring reading season. There's a lot of books coming out. I've got another trip back to Pfeiffer University to watch my daughter play some lacrosse a little bit later this month. Senior day, her last game. Oh my goodness, I cannot believe that. But I think we're going to have shows throughout. So we will have done a little of everything during the season, and that's all good. And then we'll have one more trip in May. That'll be for her graduation. So great things planned. We'd love to have you with us all the time. Money Life is independent personal finance talk. We're dedicated to looking smartly at a wide range of approaches and opinions on investing. It is not just about what I like. And I think you're going to wind up finding that, like, today's show gives you a counterpoint to yesterday's show or Monday's show. Monday, you had James Rickards on the show, the author of The New Case for Gold. Yesterday, you had Michael Ashton, author of What's Wrong with Money. Today, you've got Pat O'Hare, and he's not a wild bull by any stretch of the imagination. He's not somebody that you go, oh, man, he's just a, you know, flaming, happy-go-lucky Pollyanna kind of guy. Instead, he's been fairly realistic that for all along, he's sort of thought this market would be flat. But the interesting side is you have to decide what you believe. Like, if you're going to take the kind of strategies that Rickards was talking about on Monday, you're going to make a steady allocation to gold and you're going to manage it hard. Or that Michael Ashton was talking about, where you're going to get much more defensive. And it's not just those guys. We've had folks like Russell Napier, when he was on the show, talking about his book, The Anatomy of a Bear, where he was clearly expecting bad things to happen. If you're going to take that advice, you need to know you are taking chances, right? There was a really interesting bit of research out from OpenFolio. Now, we've talked to OpenFolio folks before, but there was a piece that Sean Langwise from MarketWatch was writing about that was taking a look at what was happening with investors in March. And the investors who got really defensive were the only ones that lost money. Like 92% of investors, according to OpenFolio, and this was like their own folks, made money in March because March was such a good month for the market. But the 8% that didn't, they were the folks who were defensive. Now, the folks who made the most money, they were aggressive, but they were aggressive by basically saying, ooh, I've got one stock. They weren't aggressive like, I'll go off and get a bunch of things. They just sort of were aggressive almost by accident, like all eggs in one basket aggressive, dumb aggressive. So they were lucky aggressive, maybe. Then you got folks who were more diversified. But the folks who didn't make money were the folks who had gotten so far into cash and so defensive that they lost money. Now, they may be proven more right later on down the line. That could totally reverse itself next month or beyond. But for the purposes of this show, that's what we're trying to teach you is, hey, there's a lot of opinions out there, and you got to be comfortable with the one you want. Because the one thing we know is horrible for you is to have a strategy that you keep changing from one thing to the next to the next. You work with whatever's hot. Means you don't actually have a strategy. You're just kind of rolling for whatever feels good. And that is generally a recipe for how investors buy high and sell low. So we don't want that to happen. What we do here on Money Life tries to bring you that wide range of approaches and opinions on investing and then make you do the decision making, the stuff that you can live with. I've told you how to get more involved in the show. I'd love to hear from you. Chuck at moneylifeshow.com. But right now, I want to get you into what we've got coming. Again, our lineup for April the 7th, Tom Lydon to Pat O'Hare to Bob Powell and then Leah Bennett. We'll get things rolling with the ETF of the week in just a moment.
Looking for alternative ETF strategies? Direction provides separate and distinct audiences with flexible investment tools to manage risk and execute short-term strategies. For more information, go to directionshares.com.
Tom Lydon joins us now for the ETF of the week. Tom is the editor at ETFtrends.com. If you are interested in the ETF world and you're looking for both suggestions on what you might look at and what is trending, but also information on what's new, what's happening, what are the developments in the business and more, check out ETFtrends.com. They are a full service site for all things related to ETFs. They're also on Twitter at ETFtrends. Tom is on Twitter. He's at Tom Lydon. Tom, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Chuck. Great to be back.
Our ETF of the week is
the ProShares Russell 2000 Dividend Growers ETF, ticker symbol SMDV.
The ProShares Russell 2000 Dividend Growers SMDV. This is an interesting pick because most people, when they think Russell 2000, of course, you're thinking small caps. But when you think small caps, you don't necessarily think dividends. So Why this mix now?
Yeah, interesting. Last week, we did a webcast with ProShares, and they talked about their dividend grower suite. So they have a discipline that they apply to large caps, mid caps, small caps, developed nations, and also emerging markets. So as you think about this ETF evolution, now with the smart beta infusion, let's say, in the ETF space, there's a lot of different strategies to think of. There are a lot of choices out there. But dividends have been very, very important to investors lately. Those that have invested in a dividend-oriented strategy, especially in the last 3 years, have been well rewarded. Also, the dividend area of the market has had less volatility than the general market indexes. So that's another area where that kind of that measure of safety, let's say, has been brought into place. However, one thing you and I continue to talk about, Chuck, are some of these disciplines that are offered within some of the ETF strategies. And the cool thing is, folks like ProShares actually can go back as they put a new strategy together and backtest these strategies, not just over the last couple years, but over the last 10 or 20 years and see how they might have done in different scenarios. And if you can test in all different types of market environments, and over time it continues to do well, the kind of inherent offer is hopefully that will happen over the next 20 years. Jury's still out. We don't know if that's going to be the case. However, as we talk specifically about this ETF, there are a couple things that come to mind. Number one, small caps in some instances actually do offer dividends as well. Mm-hmm. And if you look for a dividend grower strategy, that's just not consistent dividends, but growing your dividend over time, those small cap companies that have done that, that now make a component of this index, have actually outperformed the Russell 2000 over an extended period of time. So that's, I think, very important to understand. Number two, the way they put this together, it's not as though it's market cap weighted, it's equal weight. So it doesn't put too much weight on one specific company. They are all equal weighted, the 56 companies that represent the index underlying this ETF. So if you're looking at dividend growers because you like the income, and this has a yield right now of 2.28%, pretty good considering current market environments. Number two, small caps have underperformed large caps the last couple of years, but over time, small caps outperform, and we've seen for the first time in a long time, small caps actually start to outperform so far in 2016. So that's also been very good as well.
So we point out, this is basically a fund that's equal weighted. I mean, you're going to find that there are times when something's a little up and something's a little down, but it's basically an equal weight fund, but it's not equal weighted in terms of where the money is by industry. It's about one third in utilities. So we're not worrying about the sector allocation here at all. The idea is by established small cap companies that have the dividends that gives them the stability. And again, it's that growing dividend that is essential for being picked here, right?
That's right. Certain industry groups are known for behaving certain ways. And you tend to see more dividend oriented companies in utilities, financials, industrials. Some in consumer staples, some in consumer discretionary, not necessarily in technology. So that's why those sectors tend to be less. However, those few companies that were in the healthcare area, technology area, telecom area, that have been dividend growers do have representation. The thing is, out of the Russell 2000, there aren't that many companies that A, offer dividends, and B, offer dividends growth over a consistent period of time, but this ETF and the underlying index has found them.
Is this a 200-day moving average play?
I think for some instances it can be. I believe strongly with all the advisors that we talked to today, there are a lot of advisors that have been underweight small caps because they've underperformed the last couple of years. However, everything reverts back to the mean. So if you find that you're underweight in small cap, here's a core position if you are a buy and hold strategic allocator. If you follow trends, this is definitely an ETF to consider. It is currently above its 200-day average by about 5%. So it hasn't gone up considerably. So the 200-day average doesn't mean anything. That way you could buy this right now. You'd have 5% downside risk if you stick to that 200-day moving average. I think most importantly, that underlying dividend strategy brings some consistency to the underlying index and the components of the index, and on top of that, a decent yield while you're waiting for small caps to rebound. So it's got a lot of things going for it. Most importantly, it's a great strategy that you and I get to talk about. And as ETFs continue to evolve, it's not simple anymore, Chuck. There are some definite strategies out there, a lot to consider, but you have to look underneath the hood and really diagnose what's going on and pick out specifically those characteristics that you're looking for.
Yeah, and this one really does identify those characteristics, because a lot of folks, I always remember my father sort of having a tougher time finding small caps where he was really comfortable. But how do you get comfortable? Well, you're picking the dividend growers among the small caps. That's what happens with the ETF of the week. It's the ProShares Russell 2000 Dividend Growers ETF. SMDV, the ETF of the week from Tom Lydon. Tom, thanks so much for joining me on the show.
Thanks, Chuck.
Tom Lydon is the editor at ETF Trends. It's ETFTrends.com, on Twitter at ETF Trends, and follow Tom while you're at it. He's at Tom Lydon. Well, that's a great start to the Thursday edition of Money Life. Up next, Patrick O'Hare, Chief Market Analyst for Briefing.com. He's in for the big interview when Money Life continues in just a moment.
At Hightower, providing the best fiduciary advice to every advisory client is not just a job, it's a legal duty. Sophisticated asset management, lifetime financial planning and wealth management solutions. At Hightower, it all adds up to peace of mind. Visit HightowerAdvisors.com to learn more about the Hightower difference.
Let's face it, size matters.
Truly epic proportions.
Especially when it comes to your financial talk.
I have a plan.
Quick sound bites and rush chatter won't help you.
Blah, 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 blah.
You want more details, more depth.
Concentrate, focus power.
More to think about.
What do you think?
This is Money Life's Big Interview.
I think it's brilliant.
A meaningful conversation on money and markets.
This is why we're here.
So settle in.
I made you coffee.
You're going to be here a while.
Big interview time here on Money Life, and I'm joined right now by Patrick O'Hare, the Chief Market Analyst at Briefing.com. If you've never been, great site for lots of things that you as an investor should be aware of, following, tracking, and learning about. Again, it's Briefing.com. They're on Twitter, at Briefing.com. Patrick O'Hare, welcome back to Money Life.
Hi, Chuck. Great to be back with you.
Always great to chat with you, and we are chatting now at the end of the first quarter in a year that started off terribly and then had a big run-up, in a year that started with the Fed ready to raise rates four times and now the Fed ready not to raise rates four times. We have seen a lot of things turn in a very short period of time. Has anything changed in terms of your longer-term outlook? Because you were reasonably optimistic about the market the last time you were on, but you did say we'd travel a bumpy road to reach that optimism.
Well, that's right. It's certainly been very, very bumpy here in the early part of 2016. But, you know, what we're projecting here as far as the full year is concerned is essentially, you know, we think investors should have some low return assumptions for this year. And that's predicated on large part on the fact that earnings growth just isn't there right now. So, you know, as we have emerged from a very volatile first quarter here early in the second quarter, you know, the S&P 500 is up about 1% year to date. Coincidentally, that's about what is projected for earnings growth this year, is about 1%. So we might have essentially gotten to the point where the sledding is going to get more difficult now after that rally, that tremendous rally we've seen anyway off the February low. So still not looking for much in the way of return based on what we're seeing currently in the economic and earnings growth trends.
Okay, so we're not looking for much. Does that mean a sideways kind of flat year, or does that mean, hey, that volatility we've seen, get used to it?
Both, because I think you're going to see this, you know, this up and down type of formation here. And when it's all said and done, probably will be, you know, close to flat. our view would change if we could see something that leads to a meaningful change in the earnings estimate trends, which continue to be marked down here. But until we see that, we're not feeling all that optimistic about the return assumptions for the S&P 500 this year. And knowing, too, that, you know, at this juncture, we're also trading at a pretty full valuation at about 18 times forward earnings. You know, it's about a little over a 10% premium to the 15-year average. So that's partly also why, you know, we think that the ability to keep moving higher here could be more challenging than we've seen, certainly since mid-February.
From the standpoint of what you're seeing for the market, obviously, you're not calling for much. You're not thinking that things are going to be great. What are the things that people should be looking at in terms of diversification? Are there pockets? Are there sectors? Are there niches? Is there something there that should make people want to be interested here?
Well, sure. I mean, and a lot does depend on one's time horizon, right? So if there's someone there sitting looking at a time horizon that doesn't stretch past this year, the end of this year, we think they should have a more conservative mindset, and that it should probably be, you know, favoring some more of those defensive-oriented areas that have done quite well so far this year. But if you do have a, you know, more longer-term orientation, multiple years, say, there's always opportunities there because time is ultimately on your side. And for those particular investors, you know, we did say coming out of 2015 that there could be an opportunity to start building some of those longer-term positions in beaten-down areas like energy and materials, the retailers, and even some of those transportation names, which performed pretty poorly last year. And, you know, sure enough, we're seeing some pretty okay moves in all of those areas so far in 2016. But that is the essence of long-term investing, right? You look for these sell-offs so you have an opportunity to buy low and ultimately sell higher down the road. So we wouldn't have like a you know, an all-in approach on those names, but certainly we think that there's that opportunity there to start building some of those positions, and that there'll be some potentially good returns down the road.
You know, you talk about a market that's not going to be great, that's got volatility but sort of long-term flatness. Do you worry about inflation? Do you think that people should be looking at gold? Because you just happen to be on this show as part of a week where we've had a bunch of folks saying, or a number of folks saying, go buy gold. Market's going to go to hell in a handcart.
Well, I think, you know, you've had inflation not be a factor for so many years now, and we're starting to see in some of the, you know, the core data anyway, you're starting to see a pickup in some of that inflation there as and so it does worry us here that the Fed runs the risk of falling behind the curve here in terms of its path toward normalizing its policy rate. And because it has been so reticent to raise interest rates to this point, there could be a real source of upset for the equity market in the event you get some hot CPI numbers in the next couple of months that drive core CPI anyway, say up, you know, 2.5% or more, because then you're going to start getting a lot of accusations that the Fed has missed the boat here and that they're behind the curve, which will then, of course, lead the market to think that the Fed's going to have to raise faster and more than the market currently expects. And I can tell you right now, the market's not expecting much out of the Fed this year. The Fed funds futures market doesn't place a 50% plus probability on a Fed rate hike until December. So clearly there's some complacency built in there with respect to the Fed funds rate path. And if you get into that position of where the data comes in, you know, hotter than is expected, particularly on the inflation side, the market's going to have to recalibrate for more rate hikes than it currently expects.
In a market like this, when we always hear, well, it's a stock picker's market, which is a phrase I hate because it's always a stock picker's market, even in good times or bad. If you pick good stocks, you're going to do great. If you pick lousy stocks, you're going to do poorly. But in this kind of market, do you believe somebody is better off holding the index and at least getting what little it's going to give you? Or is this one of those times where, hey, be active, take additional chances, look for those cases where stock picking is really going to pay off?
That, of course, boils down to one's risk tolerance. But, you know, generically speaking, you know, if you have an S&P 500 right now like we do that's, you know, hardly up at all for the year, it does point to the fact that you're probably going to need to be more of a stock picker this year if you're going to capture some larger returns. And I think that might be the case here. You know, only because, again, you know, we have a broader market that's sporting a pretty full valuation here. So I think that it will be more challenging for the index overall to achieve some appreciable upside for right now. So it does lend itself probably to more of an active strategy in terms of being a stock picker in 2016.
When you take a look at the stocks you could be picking from, one sector that has perhaps more disagreement than any other right now, oil and energy. What's your outlook on what's going to be happening with oil and energy?
You know, you should expect to see continued volatility there. It's going to be, you know, pretty much pinned on, I think, the direction of oil prices themselves. But as I alluded to earlier, we do think that there's some good long-term opportunity that's availed itself here within the energy sector based on how far it has fallen off from its respective highs. And again, you know, once time horizon will come into play there, but it's a longer-term orientation, multiple years. We do like the energy sector there. It's a cyclical sector. You know, the best cure, I suppose, for low oil prices is low oil prices because demand will ultimately pick up. Assuming, of course, that these producers can somehow find a way to cut back on production there. So it could be some tough sledding here over the near term, but generally speaking, we do like that from a long-term standpoint.
In some of your commentary, you have talked about, and I'm going to use your words here, the market showing off its dad bod. In other words, the fatherly body of a middle-aged man, so to speak. You are a little younger than I am. And you know, as I like to say, I am in shape, but that's because round is a shape. But explain what you mean when you talk about the economy right now showing off its dad bod and what that means going forward.
Sure. So it really wasn't specific reference to the economy, not so much to the market itself, but I used that expression, that metaphor, simply to try to point out to Briefing.com readers that essentially you have, you know, economy that is not terrible, but it's certainly not great. And when you think back to how we all used to be or maybe dreamed of being when we were younger and in better physical shape, as we've gotten on in years, you get a little softer around the middle. And the physical shape isn't quite as great as it used to be. And that's kind of where, you know, where, what's happened. If you look, we looked at that period from 1982 to 2007, you had much stronger growth rates, higher inflation rates, better productivity, higher levels of consumer confidence. And now in this period since from 2008 to 2016, you've seen all of that sort of slow, get a little squishier, if you will, more softer. And so that was sort of the metaphor that I used to point out that we're not quite what we used to be. That doesn't mean we're in terrible shape, but we've looked better in the past.
Well, we want to check in and find out how the economy is shaping up and what you see happening as the market goes along. Thanks so much, Pat, for joining me here on Money Life.
Thank you, Chuck. Happy to be with you.
Patrick O'Hare is the chief market analyst for Briefing.com. If you want to check out his take on the market, go to Briefing.com. Look there for the big picture and page one and all the other sorts of things that they do on analysis. And you can also follow them on Twitter at Briefing.com. We just hit the halfway pole on the April 7th edition of Money Life. Up next, Bob Powell in for Senior Focus when Money Life continues right after this message.
Customize an investment portfolio with FlexShares, ETFs designed to pursue targeted goals and to adapt to changing market conditions with both equity and fixed income solutions. For more information, go to FlexShares.com.
Your retirement years are coming. Are you financially ready for your retirement?
You know, I've been thinking.
Oh, that would explain the beads of sweat.
Don't let this happen to you.
I'm afraid it's just not sufficient to refinance your home.
Where shall I go? What shall I do?
My advice to you, start drinking heavily.
Just a minute, ladies and gentlemen. I think something is happening.
Bob Powell knows where to turn and how to help you with your financial needs as you plan for or live in retirement.
Here I come to save the day.
It's all here as Retirement Weekly's Bob Powell joins Money Life every week for Senior Focus.
Senior citizens, although slow and dangerous behind the wheel, can still serve a purpose.
Bob Powell joins us now for Senior Focus, where we take a look at issues that affect you if you are retired or if you're going to be retired. And we do that with Bob because he is the editor at Retirement Weekly. He's also a columnist for MarketWatch.com in the Retire Mentors section. If you go to MarketWatch, which is where you'll find my columns, you can find Bob's columns. And then from there, links to Retirement Weekly because it too is a Market Watch product. You can follow Bob on Twitter. He's at RJPIII, but right now he's here. Bob Powell, welcome back to the show.
Chuck, thanks for having me on.
So yesterday was the big day. After years of wrangling, the Department of Labor issued its ruling on the F word, as I have come to call it, the swear word for some people in the industry, the word fiduciary. We have the new fiduciary rule from the Department of Labor. Now, the SEC sort of seems to possibly be slowly grinding towards its own, but what does the fiduciary rule that was put forward yesterday by the Department of Labor do or not do for retirement savers?
Well, let's start with, I think, what it does do, which is it might create a little bit of confusion for investors at first. In its simplest form, the rule says that advisors now have to put the client's best interests ahead of their own financial interests when giving investment recommendations as it pertains to retirement accounts, both ERISA and non-ERISA, as in IRAs. And the IRA is the big change, I think. Heretofore, advisors had to act in a fiduciary rule when it came to 401k plans, not necessarily to IRA. So this rule, in a way, extends what advisors had to do for people who had 401k plans in the past. And I think what's interesting about it is it only pertains to retirement accounts. One, it doesn't necessarily pertain if you have an advisor and you have an IRA and a taxable account with an advisor. It only pertains to the retirement account,
mm-hmm.
right? So the advisor, in one respect, will act as a fiduciary, not put their financial interests ahead of your best interests when dealing with your IRA. But when it comes to your taxable account, they can just do what's suitable. And those are two different standards. So that could lead to a little bit of investor confusion if they have to figure out when is an advisor acting as a fiduciary and when are they not, and when are they required to act as a fiduciary and when are they not. So that could be a very interesting, you know, thing as this plays out. The other is, I think there'll be some confusion about what constitutes education and what constitutes investment advice. And so the Labor Department says that they drew a clear line between these two things, that education is a non-fiduciary event, that advisors are more than able to give education, which is not a fiduciary activity, but they can't give guidance that is personalized. So I think there'll be times at which someone might be confused about, you know, where does education end and advice begin?
Isn't it great when we have a new rule that we've all waited for, and the first thing you say about what's this going to do for people is it's going to confuse them.
Yeah.
Oh, boy, what a good job they've done.
Right. Now, well, and I think maybe this is where some of the proponents of the rule, maybe they're right to say this, that instead of dealing with all this potential confusion, maybe the best thing to do is to hold every advisor to a fiduciary standard, regardless of whether it's a retirement account or a taxable account, and to ask for the very same thing that you might ask from a registered investment advisor today about, are you acting in my best interest? What are the having fees and commissions and whatnot disclosed? And holding the advisor to a higher standard as opposed to standards set by the Labor Department or the Securities Exchange Commission. And so you just do away with all the regulations and, you know, you work with the people who will abide by your standards or by standards set by, you know, fiduciary proponents. So there is that, because you might avoid all these little gray areas in the rule. You know, for instance, there's this notion that originally when in the proposed rule, the one that was proposed a year ago, that advisors may not be able to sell proprietary products because they wouldn't be able to demonstrate that those products would be in the client's best interest. But in the new rule, the final rule, advisors are allowed to sell proprietary products, provided that they can prove that they acted as a fiduciary, that they disclosed the fees, and that they demonstrated that this product is better than any other product. So what do I read when I read that? I read sales job, right? Someone's going to be able to say, oh, I'm going to sell you the proprietary product because, you know, XYZ is better than the no-load product. You know, is that really the case? I mean, can you trust someone who's, you know, repping their own fund firm?
Yeah, all this does is it makes it that you can sell them the same thing, but now you have to come up with a different case that's going to stand up if you get sued. And that, to me, is the problem here, is that we've waited for all of this, and all it really does is give you a better case if you need to sue your advisor.
And I agree, Chuck. So I think that maybe that's the best part about this rule is that for the first time it gives you recourse other than arbitration, right? So in the past, if you worked with a broker, a Series 7 broker, who didn't do right by you, you had to go to arbitration. And, you know, maybe now with the, with, if anyone breaches these contracts that will be signed, that you have this recourse. So I guess that's a good thing in some regards. That's a better recourse than arbitration, potentially.
Yeah, I would hope so. But
yeah,
ultimately, it's very interesting when you see sort of who came out liking this and who came out against it. The senior groups didn't particularly like this, and I sort of thought they would. I would have thought that the folks who were representing older Americans, retirees, et cetera, would have said, hey, this is a pretty good thing because at the very least it helps to eliminate that confusion. Somebody who's working on your retirement account has to be a fiduciary, has to put your best interest first. You have a little bit more recourse, et cetera. And yet some of the senior groups are saying it's going to confuse people. It's not going to protect them. It's going to make it harder on the smaller companies to do it. So I'm a little surprised that we don't have at least more when it comes to your neck of the woods with the retirees and the folks who are right there.
Yeah.
I'm surprised they're not happier with this.
Well, you know, AARP did come out and praise it. So, I mean, there is that. And I think there are things to be praised here, right? So is it possible that fees will get lower because of this, right? Already we've witnessed LPL lower the fees for its IRAs and other types of accounts. And we may see some fee pressure here, especially, you know, if they now have to compete against robo-advisors, which presumably are abiding by the fiduciary standard already or will, you know, somewhat easily. And so there, we could see at least maybe investors paying less for advice going forward. It's also possible that, you know, that some people will be paying more because of all the increased disclosure and compliance regulations that are in place too. So I think, you know, we may not know the intended and unintended consequences of this rule will be for many years to come because it doesn't go into effect until next April. And actually it gets phased in from April of next year through January 2018. So it may be well into 2018 and 19 before we sort of fully understand the consequences of this new rule.
Well, we will be watching it. I've written about it. You've written about it. Undoubtedly, we're both going to wind up writing more about it. But I have to say that it's interesting stuff. And hopefully it will work out the way it's supposed to for consumers.
Hopefully.
Yeah. Bob, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Chuck, for having me on.
Bob Powell is the editor at Retirement Weekly. Find his columns in the Retirement Mentor section at MarketWatch.com. Follow the links to get information on Retirement Weekly. Follow Bob on Twitter, where he's at RJPIII. The Money Life Market Call is next. Leah Bennett from South Texas Money Management will be here when Money Life continues in just a moment.
Independent and advisor-owned, Hightower ensures that best-in-class financial product and service providers compete for your business every day, a groundbreaking model that's making waves on Wall Street. Discover what Hightower can do for you at HightowerAdvisors.com.
Are you playing the market, or is the market playing you?
You done taken a wrong turn.
The Money Life Market Call helps you answer the question by discussing what's working in the investment world right now.
It's working. It's working. It's working.
It's real guidance about real investments from real experts.
I play at expert level.
You might find that next great investment you were looking for, or hear that it's time to sell something you expected to hold on to.
Let it go.
You'll learn how investment pros make decisions and what they see for the future.
See your future. Be your future.
You may be excited one moment and angry or frustrated the next.
Mr. McGee, don't make me angry. You wouldn't like me when I'm angry.
But that's just life in the market as Chuck Jaffe talks stocks, mutual funds, and more.
I can live with that.
In the Daily Money Life Market Call.
Welcome to the Money Life Market Call. And my guest today is Leah Bennett. She is the co-chief investment officer at South Texas Money Management. If you want more information on the firm after you hear from Leah, well, that's easy. STMM for South Texas Money Management, STMMLTD.com. And Leah's on Twitter. She's at Leah Bennett 4, all of which is linked up at the Money Life Show recent and upcoming guest page. Leah Bennett, it's been a while. Welcome back to Money Life.
Thank you so much, Chuck. I'm excited about being here today.
So we always start with methodology because buy, sells, and holds are meaningless if you don't know where somebody's coming from. So explain to my audience where, beyond South Texas, you're coming from when it comes to picking stocks.
Sure. No, I think it's very important before you do discuss stocks to talk about what the investment philosophy is. And we're big believers in strategic diversification. So essentially what that means is we're looking to protect on the downside. And we think that's why you hire an active manager. So we have a very strict investment discipline. We buy a combination of both value stocks and growth stocks. Usually our portfolio is weighted between 50 and 60% in value and between 40 and 50% in growth and up to 10% in special situations. And why we own value and growth is because over time, those two categories tend to be inversely related. So last year is a real good example. Growth stocks outperformed value by one of the largest margins that we've seen. And then you had kind of a reversal of that happen in the first quarter. You had value outperforming growth, which is actually the first time we've seen that happen in quite some time. In addition to that, we have a lot of risk management metrics that we put into place, or parameters that we put into place. We don't buy more than 15% in an economic sector. And if you think about any downturn that we've had over the last several years, it's really been because a sector has become overvalued. So the obvious ones are the dot-com bust. Technology was about 40% of the S&P. The financial crisis, financials were about 35% of the S&P 500. And then even in the most recent downturn, you had energy was never more than 15%, but energy was a heavier weight than it had been historically. And if you can underweight the more highly valued sectors over the long run, you're already ahead of the game. So we're very strong believers in that. And then we try to diversify within the industries within the sector. And then we don't buy more than a 2.5% position in an individual position. So very diversified portfolios that do tend to outperform, especially on the downside.
Which brings an interesting thing here. You talk about outperforming on the downside, but you talk about having the balance between value and growth. So what do you do when you have an industry like, oil, energy, where those stocks certainly have gotten to where they are value priced? At one point, they were growthy. Where do they fit in, or do they not fit in? Because when you have both sides of it, the usual course is that a value stock is underpriced. It winds up then getting to where it catches up. As it does, it morphs from value to growth. A value manager sells it. You can hang on to it, ride it out into the growth phase. And then after the growth phase, it sometimes takes that tumble and goes back and cycles into value again. So how do you account for that, and how do you account for it with something like, say, the energy sector?
That's a great question, Chuck. And I think what often is the most difficult for investors is they see a stock going down and they think it's in their minds, oh, this is becoming cheap, so I need to either add to it, or maybe I should purchase something else in the sector if something else has gotten cheap. I think this is one of the hardest things for investors on the retail side and on the institutional side. And this gets back to what your investment discipline is. So when we talk about value stocks, one of the big things that we're looking at is the integrity of the balance sheet. So we want to make sure that cash flows are fairly stable. They can be declining at a very slow rate, but not substantially. So what we're seeing that's happened in the energy space, and in energy, we've been underweight the sector for 2 years now, which the main reason I kind of mentioned that is we are in Texas, so we do have a lot of exposure to energy. If you look at the cash flow, the cash flows basically are decelerating at very accelerated rates, even now with the prices coming down. So we're staying away from most energy companies. We do believe in having exposure to all sectors, so we do own a few energy companies. We're mainly focused on natural gas, and one stock that we bought recently was recently being the beginning of the year, we bought was EQT, which has done exceptionally well. So even though natural gas prices have not done very well, you've had a nice bounce since people were so concerned that we didn't have a very cold winter, and now people are talking about how hot the summer might be, and running air conditioning does involve natural gas. So you've seen a kind of a nice bounce in some of the natural gas stocks. So we're very defensively positioned in the sector, but cash flow and integrity of balance sheets is what we're focused on. And for the most part, the oily companies still don't look attractive.
I like that. The oily companies. Yeah, they've been oily. They've been greasy and downright filthy in many respects. What else stands out to you right now? What else is something that comes through the process and is in the portfolio?
Sure. at the beginning of the year when we had the sell-off, we actually had a lot of stocks that were starting to hit our value screen, a lot more that we hadn't seen in quite some period of time. And one area where we added to the portfolio is in the materials sector. And so the entire materials sector is really sold off because of concerns about a global economic slowdown, and in particular China. But they've treated all companies the same, and we purchased Alcoa and International Paper, which both fit our criteria, and they both have more limited exposure to China and to the emerging markets. Alcoa only has 13.5% of its revenue comes from emerging markets, and International Paper is primarily in the U.S., and they both have very nice dividend yields. So those are two stocks we added. Healthcare has been a very interesting sector for the first quarter with Valeant and some of the rhetoric coming from the election. It's created some interesting opportunities. We think that's a sector you have to be very careful with, but we did add two companies to our portfolio, and long-term we like healthcare, and that's Cerner, which is a healthcare information technology company, and there is big demand basically for hospitals and other healthcare entities to become electronic and to consolidate their systems and become more efficient. And Cerner and one of its competitors, between those two companies, they've been gaining like 90% of the market share of new business that's up for bid. And their backlog's been growing at a rate over 30%. So that's a stock we like. And Bayer is an interesting company that's going through that's basically going through a transition where it's becoming more of a pure pharmaceutical company. So that's one that's in transition. It's an international company based in Germany, but a stock that we think is interesting, and you're starting to see some more organic growth there.
When you own a stock like Bayer, do you do it with the shares based in Germany, or do you do it ADR shares here?
Great question. We buy the ADRs. So we don't like taking the currency exposure, the currency risk. So we do buy them in the U.S. market.
Okay. Now that gives us an idea of what you're buying. What have you had to move away from?
Great question. As I mentioned, we have been underweight energy. We've also been underweight financials, which is kind of related to the same issue. You had a scare earlier on this year with people being concerned about what the loan exposure is, not only to the energy companies, but also to the infrastructure that's been built around the energy companies. So the pipelines and anything that's involved to basically support drilling. As a result, we've been underweight the banks, both the multinational banks as well as the regional banks, and that certainly helped our portfolios. But that's something we continue to do. We are looking at the REITs, which we think are interesting, and then we've sold some. We have some healthcare stocks that have done very well that we've sold as of late. So we are doing some kind of repositioning in the portfolio. We're also a little more conservative than we have been in the past, and we're holding a bit of cash.
I was going to say, so that means when we talk about a bit of cash, compare your current levels to your normal levels.
Sure, our normal levels are next to nothing. Is maybe 1%. If an account where we have full discretion, we're holding at least 5% in cash right now.
Okay, so that gives us an idea of what you're holding. It also gives us an idea of what you're folding. Now we're going to find out how my audience's picks fall into that scale.
Play, hold it.
You got to know when to hold up.
Or fold it.
Know when to fold up.
It's hold it or fold it time with my guest, Leah Bennett, Co-Chief Investment Officer for South Texas Money Management. If you want more information, stmmltd.com. She's also on Twitter, at Leah Bennett 4. Hold it or fold it. Well, you know how it works. But if you want to participate directly, send your name, your hometown, the ticker symbols you're interested in to chuck@moneylifeshow.com. And while we're talking stocks today, remember that we'll take your requests for stocks, mutual funds, ETFs, closed-end funds, all of that so that we can include you in Hold It or Fold It. All right, our first couple of requests today come from Joe in Colorado Springs. Now, we talked a little bit about energy. He wanted to know about Occidental Petroleum. That's OXY.
Yeah, as I mentioned, we are very cautious on the energy sector, but one of the stocks we do own is actually Occidental. It's one of the low-cost producers. As far as the exploration and production companies are concerned, we think they're actually pretty well positioned, and they've been excellent stewards of capital over the long run. Over the last 10 years, they paid out $23 billion in dividends and share buybacks, and the vast majority of that has come from internally generated cash flow, and debt has only increased a little over $5 billion over the last 10 years. So we actually do like this that company in here.
And you'd be buying it still. As you point out, there is that difference between buying and holding. You said we hold it in the portfolio. Would you still be buying Oxy right now?
Yes, I'm glad you asked that. Yes, we are purchasers at these levels.
Okay, so that's a buy on Occidental Petroleum, OXY. Joe's next request, Signet Jewelers Limited, SIG.
So Signet is an interesting company that we actually, it's one that met our growth criteria. The company was showing nice accelerating organic revenue growth. At this point, we are selling the position. The stock has done fairly well, but what we are concerned about is half of Signet's revenues are internally financed by the company. So it's really important to watch their credit trends, and we're concerned that future sales growth might need to be driven by extending credit to new customers that have lower credit scores. So that is a stock that we would be selling.
So you're taking your profits and getting out of Signet Jewelers Limited. That's a sell on SIG. A similar ticker symbol, but a very different industry. Joe's third request is SL Green Realty Corp. That's SLG.
SLG is really interesting. It's a stock that met our value criteria. We've owned the stock in the past and actually recently started repurchasing it. The stock sold off when they reported their last quarter. Their occupancy rate was around 97%, which this is the first quarter in several where it's flattened out a little bit, which is why the stock sold off. But if you look at the lease rates in its core Manhattan market, they're up 15% last year, and it's one of the strongest office markets still in the U.S. So we do like the stock fundamentally. It's got a 3% yield, so we are a buyer at these levels.
That's a buy on SL Green Realty Corp, ticker symbol SLG. John in Natick, Massachusetts, wants to know about PerkinElmer Corporation, ticker symbol PKI.
PerkinElmer is another stock that we have owned in the past that showed exhilarating growth, has substantial exposure to China, and so the stock is not showing exhilarating growth anymore. So we took our profits in the stock a few months back, and it is something I'd rate as a sell.
That, therefore, is a sell on PerkinElmer Corp, ticker symbol PKI. Dave in Vestal, New York, wants to know about AT&T Incorporated, ticker symbol T.
Yeah, the telecommunications sector overall did extremely well this first quarter and was up significantly. AT&T was actually up 15%, which is a huge move for it. This stock is still on our value screen, and despite the nice move, we still do have a buy rating on it. We do think cash flows will continue to be driven by increased mobile demand consumption. That doesn't seem to be going away anytime soon. And the dividend yield remains very attractive, and it's just under 5%.
Obviously, a buy on AT&T Corp, ticker symbol T. But there's a couple of things that are interesting there that I want to go back to methodology since we have just a little bit of extra time. You talked about how the stock has been on a nice run. It's up about 15%, but it still meets your value criteria. Well, as it's come up, the dividend yield has shrunk a little bit. And of course, you're not getting it at quite the bargain levels. So at what point on the value screen after a run up does a stock go from being a buy to a hold? How much further does this stock have to run before you go, yeah, I still like it. I still want to hold it. I'm still getting my great yield, but I don't want to be adding to my position.
That's a great question. We look at on the value screen in particular, we set price targets, and the price targets are based on the cash flow generation of the company. So even though AT&T, for example, has done very well, it's because its cash flows are accelerating. So as that cash flow growth continues to increase, even though the stock has done well, its multiple hasn't increased that much. So we look for it on a multiple of cash flow. We'll look for an exit point. So we still think there's upside in the stock. What we do not want to see, for example, which sometimes you see on the upside, is somebody who is starting to show very nice earnings growth, but the cash flow starts either flattening out or declining if it's a value stock, and that's what you don't want to see. We really look at the integrity of those balance sheets, and that kind of ties back into that energy question. Just because the stock is going up or down doesn't necessarily mean it's cheap per se.
Great for us to know. Leah, thanks so much for taking time out to join me on Money Life.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much, Chuck.
Leah Bennett is the co-chief investment officer at South Texas Money Management. If you want more information, stmmltd.com. She's on Twitter at LeahBennett4. Hey, we are just about done with today's edition of Money Life, but just about means not quite. So come right back and we'll cross the finish line together in just a moment.
PowerShares provides a different take on traditional asset categories while providing advisors and investors with innovative investment opportunities. For more information, go to PowerShares.com. Invesco Distributors, Incorporated.
Here's an odd one for you. As we're back on Money Life, in the break, I was trying to remember, we hadn't talked about Occidental Petroleum for a while, and I was trying to remember who it was, and when I went and found out who it was, the odd thing was that in that interview, we talked not only about Occidental Petroleum, but we also talked about AT&T, two of the stocks that you just heard us talking about with Leah Bennett. So it was Barry James back in November, so it's been about 5 months, that had Occidental Petroleum as a sell. Now, I don't know what he's got at this point. I'd love to get Barry from the James Funds back on the show. We've been trying to arrange it, but haven't been able to come to dates. But he had Oxy as a sell. He had AT&T back then as a buy. You just had Leah Bennett with Oxy as a buy. And then she was talking about AT&T at the end as a buy as well. So that was what you got out of that. By the way, the other person who talked about Occidental Petroleum was also near the turn of the year. That was Tom McIntyre. Not in his most recent visit just a couple of weeks ago. He had Occidental as a buy near the end of the year. So, you know, that's a really interesting thing. We say disagreement makes a market, but here you've got money managers disagreeing on the same stock. Now, admittedly, time has passed. And that makes things dangerous. But still, it helps to prove the point that, hey, disagreement makes a market. Now, what I hope nobody will disagree about is that we have a great show planned for tomorrow. We're going to wrap this week up with a fabulous lineup. Adam Grimes from Waverly Advisors will be in to talk technical analysis with us first. He's been very optimistic. So that'll be a nice counterpoint to some of the pessimism we've had on this show this week, even from Patrick O'Hare, who was maybe a little more sour than I thought he would be. We will also have Chris Gaffney. He is the president of Everbank World Markets. That's our big interview tomorrow. Greg McBride will be here. And then, of course, you're going to get John Reese from Validia talking stocks. Next week, Andrew Foster from the Seafarer Fund is one of our big interview guests. We've also got David Sharef, author of Break Up the Banks. We've got Tim Clift from InvestNet and more. On the Money Life Market Call, Charlie Clark from the USA Mutual's Takeover Target Fund, Sandy Sanders from John Hancock, John Thompson from Vilas Capital, David Miller from the Catalyst Funds, and Troy Harmon from Hensler, Director of Equity for Hensler Equity Funds. Those are our Market Call guests next week. Lock it in, folks. We will have a great time. So thanks so much for being here. Thanks to my guests today, Tom Wyden and Bob Powell, our regulars, but also Leah Bennett and Patrick O'Hare. I want to thank my producer, Rob Floyd. I want to thank you for being here. Today's Money Life quote of the day comes from Dennis Healy, who said, "The difference between tax avoidance and tax evasion is the thickness of a prison wall." As you're wrapping things up, I hope you are avoiding them and not evading them. And I hope you'll remember that until we do this again the next time, the best thing you can do for your money is to not worry too much about it. Have a great day, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow.
This show is an informational service only. The information provided herein is not to be construed as an offer to buy or sell securities of any kind, and not to be considered a recommendation to buy any stock, but an information resource to aid the investor in making an informed decision. All listeners should consult a qualified professional before trading in any security or pursuing any financial or tax strategy. The information provided has been obtained from sources which are believed to be reliable, but is not guaranteed as to its accuracy or completeness.